The theme of today's talk is a quiet heart. And this is something that the Lord has been opening to me for some time, the need for a quiet heart. How can we find it? How can we quiet our hearts before God? I had been thinking and praying about this matter for a long time before a memory suddenly clicked in my mind that I had completely forgotten. One day back in 1948, when I was a college student at Wheaton, a friend named Sarah Spiro and I were messing around on the piano, as we often did in the dormitory lounge. Sarah was a great pianist, and I gave her four little lines that had just come to me, and she set them to music. These were the four lines. Lord, give me a quiet heart that does not ask to understand, but confident steps forward in the darkness, guided by thy hand. And when that memory came to me, I realized that I had been praying that ever since I was 21 years old. God really has been answering that prayer. I think he began answering way back when I began to pray those words. But he doesn't do things necessarily on our time schedule, does he? Very often, it is what seems to us a very slow process. And probably the reason is that we are, what Jesus said, fools and slow of heart to believe. I have a strong hunch that there are many of you today who are really longing for quietness in your lives. There isn't very much of that in the world today, is there? It's very difficult to escape noise. You get in an elevator and you've got noise. You walk down in a very quiet town in Magnolia. Incidentally, my husband and I don't live actually in Boston. We live 30 miles north of Boston in a very quiet, tiny little town called Magnolia. And you find that somebody is painting a house. His truck will be 100 yards away and he's got the stereo blasting the entire neighborhood. So there are chainsaws and helicopters and traffic and the noise of people and so-called noise of music nowadays, which unfortunately does seem to me to be mostly noise. So where can we find quiet heart, quietness? Often it's impossible to find physical quietness, but it's always possible to have a quiet heart. I really believe that with all my heart. So where does it begin? Not with a theory that Elizabeth Elliot has come up with, not with any special new discovery of a technique. It comes from a long, steady, earnest, sustained gaze at God himself, at the life of Jesus. Now, Jesus lived a very busy life. The only 3 years that we know much about, presumably he lived a very quiet life for 30 years. Before that happened, that he was working in a carpenter's shop where there was a certain amount of noise. But I imagine that it was a quiet place, generally speaking. In that 3 years of people following him, people were plucking at his sleeves, constantly asking for things, arguing with him, believing him, following him, disbelieving him, interrupting his prayer times, chiding him for not being available when they wanted him. But Jesus had a quiet heart because he only did one thing. It's exactly the same thing that you and I have to do. When I get home from a trip away, I know that there will be a pile of work for me to do. And it's my natural temptation to get very frenzied and very frustrated by the thought of all this work that has to be done immediately. But I've begun to learn that I have only one thing to do, the will of my Father. That is what Jesus did. So when I keep that in mind, I find that it completely changes the look of things. It changes my life, it changes my heart, it changes my home, and it changes the way I do things. So a long, steady, earnest, sustained gaze at God himself. Now that doesn't mean that you don't also gaze at the pile of laundry and do something about it, and gaze at the onions that you need to peel for the soup. We have many things that we have to be looking at the same time. But our inner eye is directed for God. Everything is an offering. We can be peeling the onion for God. My body to begin with, my life, my heart, my emotions, my time, my work, my possessions, my sufferings, my joys, my work of every sort is an offering to God, and it gives to me a quiet heart. Many years ago, I was in a car with my son-in-law and his two-year-old Walter. And his father, Walt, decided that it was time to get the car washed. So we went into one of those automatic car washes, which can be a scary experience, even for us adults, on the first run through. And Walt hadn't explained anything at all to his little two-year-old boy, who was standing on the seat between us. These were in the days before seat belts were not required. And as the car was drawn into the dark tunnel, I looked at my little grandson's face, and I could see the fear in those big blue eyes. But his eyes went immediately to the face of his father. And then as the giant brushes began to close in and there was the roar of the water, and the fear came back into his face, and he looked around at all four sides of the car to try to figure out what in the world was happening. Now, this little boy was too young, of course, to understand exactly what was happening. His father hadn't really explained much of anything to him, and he didn't have any way of knowing if he was ever going to get out of here. But as he looked at the giant brushes, turning his head from side to side, and the cascading water coming down over the four sides, his face went immediately to the face of his father. Now, when the final crash came, when that big rubber thing comes banging down on the front windshield, once again, his eyes darted to the face of his father. And then the car was drawn out into the sunshine, and the little boy's face just broke into a big smile. He had not understood what was happening, and he didn't know whether we were going to get out of there or not. He knew one thing. He knew his father. And he knew that his father had never given him any reason not to trust him. So I'm here to say to you that my Heavenly Father has never given me any reason not to trust him. He has been faithful, utterly faithful, and I want to praise and glorify him. I want to read you the story from Mark 4, 35 to 41. That day when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said, Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, he rebuked the wind, and he said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And they were terrified and they began to ask each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Now let's notice several things about this story. A quiet heart is obvious in Jesus, or he couldn't possibly have been sleeping. And don't you love that little touch that Jesus' head was resting on a pillow? That's in there, you know, inspired by the Holy Spirit of God, preserved for you and me. God has such a tender heart. Jesus was a man. Jesus got tired. Jesus needed a few little comforts once in a while. And so he was asleep in the stern with his head on a pillow. But the disciples said, "Don't you care if we drown?" So he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the waves, "Be quiet," which indicates that he was the Lord of the universe. He could speak to the wind, and the wind would obey him. The wonderful thing about all of nature is that all of nature always obeys God. Lars and I live near the ocean, and the tide comes up at exactly the moment that it's supposed to come up every day. And it goes down exactly at the moment that it's supposed to go down every day. And I have a little card on my desk that tells me the exact moment when the tide will be the highest, always exactly according to that schedule. Now, the schedule was God's, wasn't it? The wind does exactly what he says, and the waves do exactly what he says, and all of nature does exactly what he says. But he is also Lord of everything that happens to me. The Lord brought these words to mind when I learned that my husband Jim Elliott was missing in the jungle back in 1956. But God brought to my word, Isaiah 43, 1 and 2. "But now this is what the Lord says, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you." He is the Lord of the universe. Now, I don't know what sudden violent gust of wind may have struck you recently. That's what a squall is, you know. A sudden violent gust of wind. But I do know the one who knows, the one whom I have believed. And I am absolutely sure that he is able to keep that which I have committed to him against that day. I am absolutely sure that there is no such thing as a furious squall that is out of God's control. Let me give you four lines which I think might be worth dictating so you can take them down in your notebook. I didn't write these, somebody else did. Love divine has seen and counted every tear it caused to fall. And a storm which love appointed was its choicest gift of all. Now, I know you couldn't write that all down that fast, so I'll give it to you again. Love divine has seen and counted every tear it caused to fall. And the storm which love appointed, the storm which love appointed was its choicest gift of all. I would like us to remember that if we can take stock of the fact that this storm in my life is appointed by the love of God, we will find a quiet heart. Instead of getting all bent out of shape and twitchy and uptight and saying, "Why me? Why poor little me?" Well, the very sensible question would be, "Why not me?" It is his love that appoints it. It is not out of his control. Perhaps you're saying, "But I don't see how this thing in my life can possibly be appointed by the love of God." Do you suppose for a moment that the disciples could see why they shouldn't be so uptight and so afraid? After all, it says that the boat was nearly swamped. One more wave and they would have been at the bottom. But Jesus was saying, "Why are you so fearful? Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith?" Now, what is faith? Faith is the acknowledgement that God means exactly what he says. My faith is to rest not on an outcome that I think God should work out for me. My faith rests on who God is. And the quietness of my heart is the fruit of an absolute confidence in God. Now, if you want a title for talk number one, it is Confidence in God. That is the source of a quiet heart. Now, how can we possibly go through furious squalls and big storms and long, long haul without confidence in God? Can't be done, can it? He is Lord of the universe. He is Lord of my life. He is Lord of every furious squall. So now there are going to be 1, 2, and 3 in the rest of my papers here. Number one is, who is he? He is Lord, Lord of the universe. Here are some verses which I think most beautifully bring together his stupendous power and Godhead, and his intimate understanding and interest in exactly what concerns you and me. Psalm 147, verses 3 and 4, says, "He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. He determines the number of the stars and calls them each by name." I love the juxtaposition of those two tremendous facts about who he is. He is the one who knows how to heal a broken heart. When my second husband was dying of cancer, I felt at times that I couldn't face one more day of his terrible suffering. I didn't have the physical or the moral or the emotional strength to face the hideous distortions and horrible things that the doctors were talking about doing to my poor husband before he died. It wasn't the death itself that so frightened me. It was those awful things that doctors want to do to people in order to keep them alive a little bit longer. I just felt helpless and hopeless. And I would wake in the morning in those wee small hours that Amy Carmichael used to call that, those are life's molehills become mountains in the wee small hours. One night I realized that I didn't have anything to give to God except one thing, a broken heart. Then I thought of those words, "A broken and a contrite heart he will not despise." So that's what you give him. You give him your broken heart. And more than one woman yesterday and today spoke to me with tears about their broken heart. Amy Carmichael wrote a beautiful poem which has been a watchword in my life. "Hast thou no scar, no hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet I was wounded by the archers, spent, leaned me against a tree to die, and rent by ravenous beasts that compassed me. Hast thou no wound? No wound, no scar? Yet as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that follow thee. But thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wound or scar?" Those were lines from Amy Carmichael. Powerful words, aren't they? And probably difficult to fathom without hearing it many times, but those first words, "Hast thou no scar," may cause us to reflect on some of the hard things in our lives. Remember that our Lord Jesus knows how to heal the brokenhearted and to bind up their wounds. Here I stand before you as one who knows the truth of that. Healing takes time. The binding up of wounds isn't an instantaneous or miraculous cure. Frequently, we would like God to give us miracles, wouldn't we? We've all heard those preachers on TV say that what we need is a miracle. But you know, there's only one person in the world, in the whole universe, who really knows whether you need a miracle, because the truth is that the Lord knows every tear that is caused to fall. And the storm which love appointed was the choicest gift of all. And I don't know who wrote that, but it was not I. The storm which love appointed was the choicest gift of all. Very likely it will not be the miracle that you hoped for, but simply a quiet acceptance, because in acceptance lies peace. Amy Carmichael wrote, instead of the word submission, I should write acceptance. For more and more as life goes on, that word opens doors into rooms of infinite peace. And the heart that accepts asks nothing, for it is at rest. And the pilgrim of love does not need a map or a chart. I know my road. It leads to his heart. And I had the privilege of sitting in Amy Carmichael's bedroom, surrounded by her books, sitting at her desk when she wrote this sort of thing. And of course, she wrote hundreds of poems. But as I took care of my husband, Addison Leach, when he was dying, I couldn't help hoping that God would give us a miracle. And he would suddenly see my husband, who was at death's door by then, raised up to his former strength and health. God did not vouchsafe me that miracle. My heart was broken. But the Lord of the universe is the one who calls out the stars and leads them out. He's in charge of that wonderful harmony of the whole universe, the galaxies, the stars, the planets, the moon, the sun, the atoms, the molecules, and that molecular dance that scientists tell us goes on ceaselessly in every cell or piece of matter in the whole universe. That molecular dance that scientists tell us goes on ceaselessly in every cell. And who's in charge of all that? God himself. But he also knows how to bind up your wounds and your broken heart. That is the who we are talking about. My confidence in God will give me a quiet heart. And now, number two, what he is. What did he do when the disciples were at their wits' end? You've all heard this story 100 times. He calmed the waves and the wind. But have you thought about the fact that in verse 35, it says that he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Now, what does that have to do with anything? Why is that a great lesson for you and me today? What did he do? It was Jesus who led the disciples into that storm. It was his leading. So when you find yourself in a terrible mess or a furious squall and you're just about to be swamped, isn't it natural for us to think, "Oh, I must have made a terrible mistake. I shouldn't be here. I should never have married this man. I never loved him in the first place. I don't know how I got this job. I don't know where I'd ever get another one. I must not have been paying attention to God's leading." Well, now that might be true, because sometimes we don't pay attention to God's leading and we suffer because of our disobedience and our utter ignoring of what he's trying to tell us. But then there are those times when we have agonized in prayer and said, "Lord, I want to do your will. Please show me the way." When missionary pilot Nate Saint, who you saw in the video just a few minutes ago, flying his plane, and he was in Ecuador back in 1955, he discovered the whereabouts of the Auca Indians. He had been flying for years over their territory and had never seen a sign of them. But one day he came to our station, told Jim and me he had such a most ecstatic piece of news. He said, "I have found the Aucas. I was flying over them, and there they were." Well, I'll never forget his stunning announcement. And he told us that he'd found the Aucas, and he described what he had seen from the air. And he began then what he wanted to call Operation Auca. And then he began to drop gifts from those people to those people. And of course, we prayed with all our hearts over every single detail of what Nate called Operation Auca. The weather, the flight, what gifts to drop to these people, all that was part of the planning and was prayed over and asked that God would guide. And God led those men in there. He gave them the kind of weather they needed. He enabled Nate to find a strip of sand where he could land his little plane. God gave them a wonderfully friendly contact on a Friday afternoon. They had waited from Monday to Friday. Nothing had happened. Suddenly on Friday afternoon, there was a friendly contact. Three Alcas showed up. One man, two women. Then on the following Sunday, all five of the men were speared to death. Did they make a mistake? Should they not have been there? Let me ask you this. What happens to your faith? If your faith rests in the outcome, what happened to my faith when my husband was killed? What happened to my faith when my husband Addison died of cancer? After all the prayers, all the anointing, all the words of knowledge, people coming from all over the country to tell my husband that he was going to be healed, even Billy Graham came to our home to see him and prayed over him. My confidence is what God is. What God does very often is to lead us into a storm. Why? What did this experience mean for the disciples? They learned to know who Jesus was in a way that they hadn't known before, and that they had been walking with Jesus and listening to him talk and eating with him and living with him for I don't know how long exactly. But here they are at the end of this story saying, "What is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." A new revelation of who Jesus is was because of the furious squall. When God brought those words to my mind from Isaiah 43, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you." He wasn't saying, "I'm going to give you a bridge over troubled waters." He said, when you walk through the water, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. That seems impossible. Sometimes it does, doesn't it? Any of you who are widows know what it's like when you face the death of your husband. You know that you can't possibly survive it. The waters are going to drown me, you say. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God. My confidence rests in who he is. And I look at what he does, and it doesn't make any difference whether I understand it or not. It's God who's doing it. Someone had written, "Love divine has seen and counted every tear it caused to fall. And the storm which love appointed was its choicest gift of all. Love divine has seen and counted every tear it caused to fall. And the storm which love appointed was its choicest gift of all." Now, it goes without saying that I would not be here today if my faith had rested in the outcome of either of those husbands' lives, because my faith would long since have collapsed. I wouldn't have anything to talk about. I would have packed my bags and gone home from Ecuador. You know your own experience. Many, many times when you have prayed for something, God's answer has been no. "I have something else for you. I have something better for you," he says. "I've got the whole world in my hands. Not the smallest breeze or the tiniest little lapping wave on the seashore is out of my control, nor are the furious storms. I love you, and these are my gifts. I am giving you the revelation of myself in the midst of your suffering." Now, I know God in a way that I could not possibly have known him if I hadn't had to go through some deep water. Isn't that the truth? You know that's the truth from your own experience. Think about the people whose lives have most profoundly influenced you spiritually. I can think of dozens of people who have shaped my life, most of whom I had never met in the flesh. But every single one of them has been a person who has suffered and who has been through deep waters. Would you like to have the story of Daniel without the lion's den? How about the story of Noah without the flood? The story of David without Goliath? We have all these wonderful stories in Hebrews 11 that tell us about the great heroes of the faith and all the things that they did. And then it says, and others were tortured. Right in there with the list of all the triumphs. And others were tortured. And sawn in two. Think about that one. These all died in faith. They wouldn't have if their faith had rested in a particular answer to their prayers. Can you imagine being sawn in two? Think about that. God led the disciples into the storm. His confidence in the Father was all power is given unto me in heaven and on earth. And Jesus had a quiet heart because of the power that was given to him. I can have a quiet heart because of Jesus, who is the Lord of the storm and to whom all power has been given, lives in me. Christ lives in me. Is God going to allow anything to happen to his beloved Son without his permission? When he was hanging there, words of derision and scorn were flung at him. And they said, if you're the Son of God, come down. Prove it. Show it, in other words. But he paid no attention to the challenge of unbelief. They said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. And that's the truth, in a sense, because he himself could not save because he wanted to save you and me. His confidence was in the Father. He knew that all power was given unto him, so the storm didn't bother him in the least. The violent rocking of the boat, the swamping, didn't even wake him up. There he was with his head on a pillow, quietly trusting in his Father. He wants you and me to live in company with him, to live in that peace. He presides over my destiny. You know that lovely hymn by Fanny Crosby? He leadeth me. O blessed thought, O words with heavenly comfort fraught, whate'er I do, where'er I be, still 'tis God's hand that leadeth me. I can remember my husband, Ad, when he was in the early stages of his illness, asking me to play that hymn for him on the piano. He would just shake his head and say, he leadeth me. Is it possible that he's still leading me? And of course, I had to say, yes, he is. One of the hymns that we used to sing in our family prayers at home was How Firm a Foundation. And the second and third stanzas are taken directly from Isaiah 43. When through the deep waters I call thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow. For I will be with thee, thy trials to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all-sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. My only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. Do you believe that? How many of you really believe that he is not going to forsake you? You don't need to put your hand up, but I want you to ask yourself that question honestly. Do you really believe that promise? It happens that in the original language of that verse, there are five different negatives. We don't have five different negatives in English. We can't even use two negatives in one sentence without canceling them out. You can't say, I ain't got nothing. That's two different negatives, which means I do got something. But that's not the way it is in the original language, so unfortunately we don't have the force. There's no way except to repeat, never, no, never, no, never forsake. But it is even more powerful in the original language. Anyway, if you really believe that, you have a quiet heart. That should be the rule of our lives. It doesn't make any difference what happens. It doesn't make any difference at all if the boat is swamped or the wind is shrill and everything seems to be falling apart and we are about to go to the bottom of the sea. Jesus is there and he's in the boat. Another word from Amy Carmichael, hold us in quiet through the age-long minute while thou art silent and the wind is shrill. Can the boat sink while thou, dear Lord, art in it? Can the heart faint that waiteth on thy will? Hold us in quiet. God can do that. Only God can do that. There's no quietness to be found in the world. But Jesus said, peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Now, number three is trust in God. Confidence in God means abandonment of myself. Now, that's going to be very difficult in this day and age when we are told that we are supposed to be loving ourselves. Have you ever heard that nonsense? It's got to be one or the other. You can't have it both ways. So you can choose to love yourself, and that's going to be a full-time job for the rest of your life. You're not going to have much time to love anybody else. Or you can choose to abandon yourself to God and greatly increase your confidence thereby. Lord, I can't do a thing about this. The boat is sinking. We've done everything we can. You can imagine the poor disciples just frantically bailing to the point where it was futile to try to bail anymore. And the next wave was surely taking them to the bottom. And at that, you abandon yourself to God and you say, Lord, I'm helpless. You're going to have to do it. And my confidence is that God does know how to do it. It means abandoning all my worries, all my schemes, all my suggestions to God. Now, you might do it this way or that way. And when you have run out of all the possibilities and you're in turmoil, you say to God, Lord, I really do believe you know what you're talking about. I do believe you've got the whole world in your hands, and I'm going to trust you. Again and again, we want to know exactly what is happening right now. You want to know the answer to any number of 100 questions. Now, I think back to when I was a college student saying, Lord, are you ever going to give me a husband? I was a senior, and I was in what we called senior panic in those days, and I was on a college campus, and I figured that if you don't find somebody to marry on a college campus, a Christian college campus, then I'm not going to find anybody anyplace. And what did God say when I said, Lord, are you going to give me a husband? He didn't say yes. He certainly never said, I am going to give you three. That would have been the worst news I could have imagined. His answer was two words. You know what they are. I just told you. Trust me. And that's what he says to you and me. In order for me to trust him to the point of utter quietness, I have to surrender my worries, my anxieties, my plots, my schemes, my suggestions. And now, of course, it's reasonable and it's right and proper that we should pray for what we think is right to pray for. We are to make our requests known to God. All preoccupation with myself leads to turmoil, destroys a quiet mind. If I'm preoccupied with myself, working on my self-image, trying to fulfill myself, do you know what I'm asking for there? I'm asking for the kind of peace that the world can give. When I let go of myself and put myself totally at the disposal of God, he gives me his kind of peace. Supernatural, that the world can never give. Sir Thomas Browne of the 17th century pondered Psalm 16:5. Lord, you have assigned me my portion and my cup, and have made my lot secure. He also said, when I survey the occurrences of my life and call into account the finger of God, I can perceive nothing but an abyss and mass of mercies, things which others termed crosses, afflictions, or misfortune, seem to me now the secret, hidden, disguised favors of God's love. Psalm 131, verses 1 and 2 says, "My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have stilled and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me." May we ask these questions of ourselves. Am I willing to understand? Am I willing to rearrange my life? Am I willing to be healed? Sometimes we just want to wallow, you know. Am I willing to lose my life? I'll give you those again. Willing to understand, willing to arrange your life, willing to be healed, willing to lose your life. Do I want solutions or do I want holiness? Do I want answers or do I want orders from the Lord himself? Do I want the light of Christ or of my own logic? Am I willing to become like a little child? May the Lord give us a quiet heart based on our confidence in him. God bless you.